from the studios, 2RP8 in Sydney. This is 30 Laps with Dick. I'm Richard Lyon. What have we got this week? Well, how about we do lunch again? What a great idea. I thought you'd never ask. So let's do lunch with an aristocratic motor mouth, Sir John Whitmore. Who? Yeah, I know. I don't know much about him either. That's why we're going to lunch this week. 30 Laps. Pass the HP sauce, Sir John. And that slot car set, hey? The one that could match Rod Stewart's huge model railway. Let's take a look at that as it sold recently. And I'm sure something else will blow in the car window if we've got time during these 30 laps. So let's just see what turns up, hey, as we go around that slot car track. So, let's get cracking, shall we? From the December 12 edition of Motorsport magazine, Lunch with Sir John Whitmore. An unlikely aristocrat, he raced for just 8 years, but that original thinker squeezed in a lifetime's worth of experience against the very best during racing's golden era. Written by James Mitchell. He writes, in more ways than one, Sir John Whitmore is different. Since this monthly series began in motorsport 6 years ago, I've been lucky enough to take some 80 motorsporting personalities to lunch, and I don't think any of them has had such a short racing career. Probably none has had so strange a life since walking away from the sport either. But John makes a worthy and fascinating lunch guest because of the cars he raced, the people he raced against, and the magical period in which he was racing, the early 1960s. Those years formed a watershed, dividing the Devil May Care days when even top-level motorsport was still mainly for fun, from the looming era of professionalism. When John won the 1961 British Saloon Car Championship, the BTCC of its day, his mount was a second-hand 850 Mini he'd bought for £400. 5 years later, he was part of the massive Ford onslaught on Le Mans with a $1 million budget. Huge motorhomes, armies of mechanics and engineers, and suited executives on the phone nervously reporting back to head office in Detroit. That change helped him decide, after just 8 seasons, to turn his back on a flourishing racing career and move on to the next stage of his life. John was born in the aristocratic splendour of Orsett Hall, a 7,000-acre estate surrounding a 17th-century stately home in Essex. It had only been in the family since his grandfather's time. The then incumbent Digby Winfield Baker was playing cards with John's grandfather for high stakes and lost. Having no money, he handed over the entire estate to pay the debt. But it turned out to be mortgaged up to the hilt, and the house was almost falling down and barely habitable. When my grandfather died in 1907, my father had to turn all that around, make the estate profitable, create a successful working farm, and restore the house. He did it extremely well. He commanded a brigade in World War I, got the DSO, and was mentioned in dispatches 4 times. Then he served as Lord Lieutenant of Essex for 22 years, for which he was created a baronet. But the thing was, he was of a different time. He was born in 1872, so he was already nearly 30 when Queen Victoria died. When 1937, when I was born, he was 65. He never drove a car. I was sent to Eton, as he had been, and then to Sandhurst to become a soldier. But I got a poisoned hand from a fishhook and was invalided out. so I switched Cirencester to learn how to be a farmer. Beside my parents, who were both eminent people, I just felt like the little guy. I needed to prove myself somehow, demonstrate that I could make something of myself. I'd heard about Le Mans, and I thought, if I make it my goal to be in that 24-hour race just once, I'll be satisfied. I did the RAC rally in a borrowed A35 and finished. And then somebody said, there's a racing driver living up the road in Chelmsford. You ought to talk to him. That's how I met Alan Stacey, whose speed with his own Lotus sports cars had earned him a seat at Team Lotus. He gave me lots of good advice, and the upshot was if I got myself an old 1172cc Lotus 6 and had half a dozen low-key races to get my signatures. The Lotus Elite was just getting into production line yet then, and the early cars were only being sold to known heroes. But Alan said to Colin Chapman, why don't you let Whitmore have one? Trouble was, my father had no idea I was motor racing. He never did find out until my mother told him when I won the British Saloon Car Championship about 6 months before he died. She was wonderfully supportive. She didn't like me racing, but she understood that I had to do it. Colin said he'd sell me an Elite for £1,400, and she gave me the money. I got a pre-production car, number 4. John's impact on the British GT racing with the Elite was immediate. He won his first race at Snetterton, turned the car over at Mallory Park 2 weeks later, avoiding a backmarker, and then put it on the front row for Silverstone in May. Right alongside Moss, that's Sterling, of course, in an Aston DB4 GT, and Salvadori in a Coombs Jaguar, and Colin Chapman himself in a Works Elite. In the race, he finished 5th overall and 2nd in class. Back in the paddock, Colin said he wanted to fix me a ride at Le Mans, but I didn't take him seriously. On the Monday, there was a phone call from a farm office from a Mr. Chapman. I thought it was a seed merchant. When I realised who it was, I nearly fell over. The upshot was, I was put in the Border Reavers Elite for Le Mans 1959 with Jim Clark. I've been racing seriously for only 3 months. Just as an aside, Colin Chapman was the owner, chief designer, engineer and overall control of Lotus in the 60s. But I digress. At Le Mans, Lotus lodged the cars in a little village garage not far from the track, like people did back then. Alan Stacey was driving a 750cc Lotus 17. Colin reckoned it could beat the French in the index of performance, and he and I were sharing a room over the local cafe. Jim Clark, was there too. He had still never raced a Works Lotus and was new to Hornsey Gang. Or the Hornsey Gang, I should say. Few people knew that Alan had lost a leg in a motorbike shunt when he was a teenager, and he walked perfectly well. He just needed a twist grip on the gear lever to blip the throttle on the down changes. We were reading a piece in the French newspaper, and it said, one of the drivers in the 24-hour race has a false leg. I wonder who that is, said Jimmy. Alan said, it's me, Jimmy. Jimmy said, don't be so silly. Who is it, really? He thought he was joking. Next morning, Jimmy came bursting into our room saying, come on, you guys, time to get up. Alan's tin leg is lying on the floor. Jimmy was so embarrassed. Alan and I had a bloody good laugh about it. In the race, Jimmy and I were several seconds a lap faster than the other Elite, the Lumsden Riley car, until the starter failed. You weren't allowed to change the starter motor, so the mechanics hid a new starter in a bucket of water, took off the old one, making a pantomime about how hot it was, dunked it in the water supposedly to cool it down, and of course pulled out the new one and fitted it to the car. All that lost us masses of time, so the other Elite won the class. We were 2nd and 10th overall. 2 weeks later, Border Revivers entered John at Charter Hall in the Lister Jaguar normally piloted by Jim Clark, the first big car he'd ever handled. He won 2 races. In September, I took the Elite to Italy to race at Monza. On the back straight, I saw a haze in the mirror and thought my engine was about to blow. But it was the brake fluid leaking on the exhaust. When I hit the brake for the parabolica, the pedal flopped to the floor. I tried to spin it, but it hit the barrier on the inside and took off. When it all stopped, the Elite was just a heap of shredded fiberglass. All we brought home was the engine and the gearbox. John Ogier, a wealthy local chicken farmer and prolific entrant, threw his Essex racing. I was racing my own Elite at Snetterton and got the news that Alan, my first and my closest racing friend, had been killed. But we all set off for Le Mans as usual. I drove down in my minivan, which was the cheapest new car you could get, £390, and no purchase tax, because it counted as a commercial vehicle. Jonathan Sheaf, who was on the reverse list with the conventional 121.6cc Elite, was named as Innes' co-driver in the 2-litre, but in Wednesday practice, he scared himself, and so Costigan approached me. I practiced the 2-litre on Thursday evening. Innes reckoned it was unstable and lacking in brakes, but it felt okay to me, and it was certainly bloody quick. Meanwhile, Jonathan took the 1216cc out for a few practice laps. Flat out on Millsane Straight, he went straight off and hit a building. I think something must have broken. He ended up on the opposite side of the road from the wreckage, in the dark. It was several seconds before we found him, or they found him. He was in a very, very bad way. Roy Salvadori and Innes and I went to the hospital, and Jonathan was screaming. You could hear him all over the building. He was semi-conscious and in appalling pain. We were sure he was going to die. Alan, who of course was Innes' friend and teammate, as well as my friend, was already dead. Bristow was dead. Michael was badly smashed up. Sterling's legs were broken. All within 6 days. We went back to a little hotel. I was sharing a room with Innes, and Innes couldn't go to sleep. He kept talking and talking, till about 3 a.m. he said, "We're not going to run this race. I'm going home. I want to leave now, this minute. I need to borrow your car." There was no arguing with him. I gave him the keys to my minivan. He loaded up his stuff and disappeared into the night. Innes Ireland recounted the same tale in his famous autobiography, All Arms and Elbows. I was sick to the stomach of the whole thing. It was purely an urge to escape, he said. But being the man he was, 4 days later, he returned to France for the French Grand Prix at Reims. Right back on form, he qualified fourth ahead of the Ferraris and was second when in another Ferrari, and that failed. His front anti-roll bar fell off. I won the British Saloon Car Championship outright. At the end of the season, there was a race on the Lons circuit at Brands, and for that I lent the Mini to my friend Steve McQueen, who was over in Europe filming The Great Escape. Mike Parks won in a 3.8-litre Jag, but all our eyes were on the frantic battle for the class victory between the Minis of Vic Elsford, Christabel Carlisle and McQueen. The three of them crossed the finish line as one, with Elford just getting the verdict from Ms. Carlisle and McQueen. As newly crowned champion, John was on the podium to present the prizes. I got to know Christabel very well, because Don Moore, another friend of ours, prepared her car as well. She was so young and demure and pretty that nobody took her seriously at first. But she was a brilliant driver. We shared her Mini in the long-distance race at the Nürburgring, and I knew immediately she was good. In all the British Championship races, she was usually my closest challenger.
Running to and fro, hard working at the mill, never fail in the mail, yet come a rotten bill. Too much monkey business.
I took my green Mini to a meeting at Roskilde in Denmark. Stirling Moss was running in the Formula 2 race, and in my race I was up against a horde of Saabs. I think I finished second. Stirling was with a Spanish air hostess and introduced to him by Joe Bonnier. She was recovering from an accident on a TWA flight in very rough weather. The captain had told everyone to put on their seatbelts. One passenger was struggling with her belt, so Gwynilla, that's her name, Gwynilla got up to help her. At that moment, the plane dropped 500 feet. Gwynilla went up, hit the roof, came down and sprawled all over the back of the seat and broke her back. She was still recovering when I met her again at Le Mans. I was racing the old Healey 3000 DT300 with Bob Althoff. The Healey was heavy and slow, but kept going for 19 hours. Gwynilla came back to London with me and we started a relationship. Steve McQueen said to me, "Don't marry her, won't last more than 6 years." He was very savvy at reading people. We did marry, and it lasted exactly 6 years. As for Steve, that famous motorcycle jump at the end of the Great Escape was done by another good friend of mine, Bud Ekins, a top American trials rider who also drove the Mustang for some of the stunts in Bullet. Steve did try the jump himself first because he didn't want a stand-in to do anything he couldn't do. But the insurance people turned up and they didn't like it at all. And when the cameras were rolling, it was Bud on that Triumph 650. In the summer of 1962, John's father died and suddenly he was Sir John Whitmore. Sir John Whitmore Bart. It bemused people because I'd never given the impression of being much of a gent. I rather rebelled against the English class system and never mixed it with the so-called upper classes. I used to tell Jack Sears, who was an East Anglian farmer too, that he was much better all that stuff. He should have been the Sir, not me. John did a lot of races in jazz musician Chris Barber's Pale Green Elite, winning outright at Spa in the heavy rain and leading his class at the Goodwood TT until the engine failed. In the 1963 British Saloon Car Championship, he scored the most points and won the class in the Works Mini Cooper S. But under a points-dropping rule, the overall title went to Sears. At Le Mans, I was with Olof in the Sprite, which was terribly boring and slow. About 1 a.m, Bob had a huge shunt at White House and the car was destroyed. I also managed to do two Monte Carlo rallies, one in a Vauxhall Cresta instead of a real car, and we finished, and one in a Sunbeam Alpine, and we crashed. He also drove a Lotus Elan 26R for Stirling Moss's Smart Team. It looked very different because Frank Gostin had modified the bodywork, but it was no better than any other Elan. It had a dreadful habit of shedding wheels, and in all my races with it, I either won or finished in the ditch. In 1964, Whitmore shared a GT40, that's a Ford GT40, with Atwood at the Nürburgring's 1,000-kilometre race, retiring with broken engine mounts, and at Le Mans with Innes Ireland, only for the engine to fail after 6 hours. He was racing Lotus Cortinas for both Alan Mann and for Team Lotus with Jim Clark, sometimes his teammate. Jimmy and I always talked a lot about farming, which was his life. He'd got into racing almost by mistake. He wasn't socially aware at all. He was uncomfortable with the jet-set elements of international racing, and he was very awkward in lots of ways, but not in a car. But as soon as he got behind the wheel, he was totally focused. You could ask him detailed questions about a car's behaviour, and he'd be clear and specific. When he came to London, he lived in my flat, which we called the Scottish Embassy, because Jackie Stewart used to stay there too. Out of the car, he couldn't make a decision to save his life. In the evening, I'd say to him, "Do you want to go to a movie? Which restaurant do you want to go to?" He couldn't make up his mind about anything. Sally Stokes wanted to marry him, but he couldn't decide whether to marry her or not. He got tougher later, tougher with Chapman, tougher with his girlfriends. But it wasn't easy for him. In 1966, John did a single-seater race in an Alan Mann Ford Falcon, setting the first 100-mile-an-hour saloon lap of Silverstone on his way to victory. He was second in the Monza 1000K race with Mustin Gregory in a GT40 and second in Spa, 1000 kilometres in a 7-litre Mark II with Frank Gardner, our Australian Frank Gardner, as it seems. John and Frank were paired again at Le Mans, and out of the 8 7-litre Mark IIs in the lineup, John qualified third overall, behind Dan Gurney and Ken Miles, and ahead of the eventual winner, Kiwi Bruce McLaren. While I'd practiced the Le Mans start, I had the seatbelts hanging ready, tied with cotton, and my car was first to move, and I stalled it. I got going again very quickly. Ford has told us not to race each other, but going down the Mulsanne on the first lap, I passed a lot of people on the grass, got back to where I should have been, but we were out by Saturday evening. We'd had a clutch problem in practice, and Ford said they'd fix it. Alan was doing well, all the chassis set up, but Ford were doing the engines and running gears themselves. After 6 hours, the clutch was done for. I was always unlucky at Le Mans. The only time I ever finished was that first year with Jimmy in the Elite. By now, John recalled that the motor racing had changed. It was serious big business, and of course, it was very, very dangerous. The previous September, Jack Sears' career had ended in a life-threatening crash testing a Lotus 40 at Silverstone. In April, Will Hanskin was killed at Le Mans, and in August, Ken Miles died at Riverside. It was time to take stock. I proved to myself what I'd set out to prove. I wasn't interested in proving it to anyone else. Now I decided to look inside myself for life's answers. I had a manager running the farm for me, and I knew I'd never do it as well as he did. It took a staff of 5 or 6 just to run the house. I was paying tax at 91p in the pound. So I sold the house and estate and moved to Switzerland as a tax exile. While I was racing, a lot of us used to fly. At first I had a single-engine Musketeer, which I could land almost anywhere. I could drop it into the Brands Hatch car park. Then I traded up to a twin-engine Beach Travel Air. After I'd stopped racing, I got my instrument rating as a qualified commercial pilot and kept a turboprop Aero Commander at Geneva Airport, as you do. Wanting to alter the way he approached life, John enrolled in the Eastland Institute in California, which focuses on humanistic education. He met his second wife, Diana, there. Then, for 10 years, he lived in an alternate community in upstate New York. Back in England, he started an executive training firm, Performance Consultants, to exploit what he calls the GROW model: goals, reality, options, and will. John now lives alone in a small, unpretentious flat, a far cry from the country mansion in which he grew up, and concerns himself with understanding how lives should be lived, responsibly, to the general benefit of humankind. There's so much stuff in our brains that we don't use and don't explore. We all have this technology now, but we don't have the wisdom to use it responsibly. I don't regret the loss of Orsett Hall. I don't miss my planes, my boat on Lake Geneva, my house in the Bahamas. Getting rid of all my wealth I once had was enriched me enormously. Life is a journey and wouldn't want to stay in the same place. I was very lucky to race when I did. We still had the old Nürburgring, the old Spa. It was before Jackie Stewart came along and shortened all the circuits. Rightly so, of course, because of the huge death rate at the time. But because I was racing then, I was living through the greatest experience imaginable. They were the vintage days. And that was our lunch with Sir John Whitmore. And it came from Motorsport Magazine, December 2012 edition. And it was written by Simon Taylor. I wrongly attributed it to James Mitchell. Sir John died on the 28th of April in 2017. Great story from the golden age of motor racing. From drive.com.au, Charlie Bullis writes, "The ultimate slot car track sold for $90,000 in an online auction in the US. A custom-built Big Kid Dream slot car raceway set up in a household man cave has sold for nearly $90,000 Australian. With no reserve price listed, more than 21 watches and 88 bids were received to secure the 6-metre section of wooden track. The 132 scale, inspired by Virginia International Raceway, has a three-lane hand-painted surface with banked cornering, elevation-changing miniature tyre walls and an overpass. 25 cars to choose from, three players can relive their ultimate childhood fantasies, racing Ferrari Challenge and Porsche 911 Cups, Tour de Le Mans prototypes and vintage Fords, all with individual liveries and working headlights. Built in 2012 by US-based 3D model experts Slot Mods, the 2-metre-wide layout plugs into a US-style wall socket and the tablet-controlled track comes to life. Three trigger controllers are stationed along the front straight and the vintage vantage point is perfect for crushing your competition and admiring the craftsmanship. The seller, who needed to offload the mega track due to downsizing his home, has committed to donating $5,000 of the purchase price to a charity of the buyer's choice. Thank you, Charlie Bullis from Drive.com. We've probably got time for a car fact, or a weird car fact, haven't we? We can't break the tradition now. Samsung. Yes, that Korean company that makes your phone and your TV. Briefly also made cars. It started in 1994, but was clobbered by the Asian financial crisis of 1998. It sold the company to Renault in 2000. And finishing with Ford's robots. It's believed that in the 1950s at Ford's engine factory in Cleveland, Ohio, a Ford executive proudly showed off some of the firm's first robots to the famed United Auto Workers Union boss, Walter Reuter. He quipped, "Walter, how are you going to collect union dues from these guys?" Reuter shot back, "How are you going to get these guys to buy your cars?" Yes, very true. Well, there goes our two car facts for this week. So from the truncated history of Sir John, now you know a little bit more about the man. And I'm sure if you want to look him up in just about any auto racing encyclopedia, he's there with bells on. And we had a quick look at that crazy slot machine or slot car set. I don't know. My house wouldn't be big enough anyway, I don't think. My wife would go nuts if I spent that sort of money. Quite rightly too, I think. Thanks for your company today. I hope you've enjoyed John's story. It was quite interesting. Until next week, when we'll talk about something else completely different, but motoring, I'm sure. Until then, bye for now. Thank you.